White supremacy is everywhere, right? It's not just in the United States. I mean, we've gotten pieces from France, from Brazil, from places all over the world where they're connecting George Floyd to someone who was killed in their country by the police.
Hello, everyone. This is Michael, and welcome to this episode of Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute. In this episode, we are taking you back to March 25th, 2020, the day George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis. The protests and riots that followed changed Minneapolis, continues to change the United States and the world. On a project-based level, it also changed how a team of researchers of the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul continued their work. What started originally as indexing street art as a means of communications has changed to reflect the social, racial, and cultural perspectives within communities and the world. The project was created by Dr. Todd Lawrence, Dr. Paul Laura, and Dr. Heather Shuri with the Urban Art Mapping Research Project and student research collaborators Tiaren Daniels, Summer Erickson, Shukrani Nagvala, Hannah Shogren-Smith, and Chuoma Uwagwu. The team is based in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. Today via Zoom, we welcome Drs. Heather Shuri and Todd Lawrence and student researcher Chuoma Uwagwu. In the show notes, you will find a video that the GEI recorded with Dr. Lawrence with George Floyd's a mural as backdrop and a link to their website, georgefloydstreetart.omica.net.
Yeah, for me, it's always strange to watch yourself on video and to hear yourself. We've been doing a lot of interviews with a lot of different organizations and publications and things like that. And so when you see yourself on TV talking about something like this, it's a little bit strange, but I'm happy that I generally agree with what I said. That makes me feel good. I also like the fact that I'm standing next to that piece, that Blues for Joy for George stencil. I think that was a really good choice for us to have me stand there, and it I think it really adds to it. I'm really happy about that.
I really enjoyed seeing the different images of murals from around the world. Some of them I have seen, because a lot of what I do right now is helping catalog our submissions that we get in from people who just take to the streets and document art. But a lot of what I've been working with right now has been from Minnesota. So it was just really cool to see all the murals from around the world, and especially what Dr. Lawrence said about when people see the image of George Floyd, they can identify it with, you know, people in their own communities, whether that is indigenous people who've had their rights taken away or just other Black people. So you could definitely just tell that through the different murals that were in the video.
Yeah, Todd, it was so interesting that you said you're glad that you agree with what you said at that time, because when the video first started, I thought, wow, this seems like it was so long ago that we started this project, because I think that video was made a couple weeks or maybe even a week into the project. And it's interesting because I think our goals have remained really consistent throughout. We're really dedicated to preserving and documenting this art. But every day we're talking through different ethical issues and different ideas about what belongs in the database and what might not fit in the database and where we're taking it in the future and how we can make these materials useful to people. So, you know, it is interesting to see how much has really stayed the same over that course of time, but also just noticing the little shifts that we've made over the course of time as well in terms of how we build the collection and what we plan to do with it.
It started before George Floyd was murdered. How did it actually even come to this project? What was the impetus?
How did it start? Well, about 2 years ago, our lovely professors and one who's not here right now, Paul Laura, decided to map murals in the Midway neighborhood, which is, I don't know if you were in the Midway neighborhood when you took this video, but so it was a lot of mapping murals, talking to community members. We were cataloging stickers and tags and everything under the sun. And, you know, when COVID hit, we kind of realized that we can't do in-person interviews, we can't do in-person meetings anymore. And so Dr. Shuri came up with the idea to have a COVID database. And so that's like really widespread. So we were crowdsourcing COVID images from around the world. And then a few weeks into that project, you know, the murder of George Floyd happened. And that happened, you know, right in our backyards in Minneapolis, in actually the neighborhood that we were studying, the Midway neighborhood. And so Dr. Shirey again had the wonderful idea to start the anti-racist street art database, again, cataloging. And that's really picked up a lot of steam because it is so local. And so, you know, a couple blocks away from the school, the university that we research at.
I think you're giving me a little bit too much credit for some of that, Choma, because it's true that I was on sabbatical and I was supposed to be doing this comparative research project around the world. So I was supposed to be going to other cities and comparing their street art to what we have in St. Paul in terms of gentrification, which was an issue we were interested in. So yes, then I started thinking, what can I do for my living room? So I started studying COVID-19 street art. But even I think around the time when I started cataloging all that, Todd and I and the students on the research team started talking about anti-racist street art as well, which has been a common theme even before this time. And so we thought a database would be good. And then, you know, it really all came together in this moment of crisis. And we had some of the ideas worked out about how to build an archive. And it just really seemed necessary at that moment to do this archive. But we have to do it all as a team because we all bring so many different skills to it. As Choma said, we have Paul Laura, our geographer on the team, and all the students are from an interdisciplinary background. And it's constantly growing and changing, and it's shaped by all those experiences.
What was the intent to catalog images and just simply call it a day at that point? Or was the intent to actually look at it perhaps from a social perspective, anthropologically as well, and go deeper behind the meaning into each image?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I was thinking about how when I started the COVID database, at first I was just interested in the images. And so I had this very rudimentary spreadsheet. And then I realized that what we needed to do would quickly outgrow that. We needed to capture all this metadata. We needed to know what were the themes of the works, where are they located, when did they appear? Because if we're going to really contextualize and analyze the images, we have to be able to put all that together. So we really didn't want it to be just a repository where you could go and flip through a slideshow of different images. We really wanted to build in that analysis. So the metadata includes all of those things, a description of the work, some of the key themes pulled out, some of the concepts that are repeated over and over. We group them together by kind of constructs or ideas that bring them together and unite them so people can really explore them in relationship to these themes. And you can also look at them on a map so you can think about what appears in different places at different points of time as well.
Is there any thought, any deeper thoughts to saying, well, what does this image mean? Why is it there? Why is it in this particular location? Is there an evaluation and analysis to that degree?
I think that, you know, that's something that we're thinking about. I think, though, that, you know, everything's happened so fast and we have so many images that are, you know, that are backlogged to be entered into the system. And then, of course, we have been trying to publicize the database to raise awareness about it so more people will submit to it. So I don't know if we've gotten to that point in a kind of broad fashion, but we're definitely thinking about it. And, you know, the three of us were actually just at 38th in Chicago yesterday at the memorial site. And we were really talking a lot about sort of all the different elements that you would see in the database and how that was functioning at the memorial site, you know, seeing those, all these different pieces of art in situ, you know, seeing them right there and how they interact with each other. And we had like a really interesting conversation about that. So I think that, you know, knowing that the majority of the pieces of art that are cataloged in or, you know, collected in our database, that they're probably gonna go away or move or be, you know, they're gonna be collected somewhere. They're not gonna be where they originally were. That it's important to know, you know, to be able to see a picture of them, know where it was, have an idea of that location in relation to the location of another piece. Like, that's going to allow people to be able to think about that question that you just asked. Like, what exactly does it mean? What is this an expression of? What does this piece speak to directly? Is this just an incitement to action? Is this asking the viewer to think about something? Is this asking the viewer to analyze their own position in this? All those different questions, I think, can still be gotten at by engaging with our database because of what Heather said, because of the metadata that we provide along with with the images. And I'll just add, sort of piggyback one more thing on to what Heather said, is that there were, like, probably every big publication was doing, like, here's a list of murals that come, you know, from the uprising. And they were just these sort of slideshows of murals. And so people were already doing this sort of, let's just collect the images and let people see them. But what we realized or figured out we needed to do was to do more than that, was to give that contextual information as much as possible. And then even to, like, we've got pieces in our database that, you know, the image of them taken a day after the uprising, and then another image taken 2 weeks after the uprising, and you can see a difference, and then maybe another picture taken, you know, even further down the line than that. So we can see them changing over time as well.
And as you see images come in, and you've alluded to this on at our recording, at the video recording, the images perhaps have changed a little bit in narrative, where at first it was the expression of rage, of anger, and that narrative seems to have changed. And I'm wondering to which degree, how fast did the change come on, and what has resulted from that, just simply based on the imagery?
I would say in the very early days, they were centered around rage, mainly because everything was happening so fast. All you had was a can of spray paint and to go out to the street and express the message. And I think the images of anger are still very much present, but I think now we're seeing more messages of, you know, community and love and unity, things like that. Because those are the ones that just take a little bit more time. They're like more grand, they're like a lot larger, have a lot of moving pieces, so they just take a little bit longer. But I would definitely say that the anger is still there, just coming out in different ways.
From what we've seen, I mean, we've been on the streets a lot and seen a piece that was expressing that kind of, you know, violent response, lashing out at the police, et cetera, and then come back a couple weeks later and seeing something up over top of it. Or seeing pieces that people have sent us, images of pieces where it's pretty clear that behind a board was a piece, you know, some graffiti that was much more sort of violent or confrontational, and then somebody's put a board up over top of it. And that indicates either that they didn't want to see that anymore, or they thought that the piece on the board was more beautiful or more important or something like that. But I mean, you know, Heather was telling me that one of our contributors, she asked about this, how do you think images are changing over time? And this is a person that goes out every day and shoots pictures for us and sends us pictures. And that person said that she's seeing more anti-police stuff rather than less. And so that was kind of surprising. That was just yesterday. That was kind of surprising for me to hear that. So that's her perception, you know, as a person who's, you know, taking pictures every single day. I think, you know, my perception, just again, anecdotally, and then just from what I've seen in the database, is that it seems like there's just more of these larger murals that are, I think, even more than just like being sort of like sugary, like, you know, everything's okay now or something. They're more about imagining the kind of world that people want, right? They're about a kind of a envisioning of a world where people don't get killed by the police for no reason, or maybe a world in which we don't need police, right? Like, that's sort of part of this thinking about and conceptualizing a different world that we could live in. That's a lot of what I see in these murals that have, let's say, proliferated, you know, a couple weeks after the uprising.
I agree with everything both Nod and Choma said, as usual. I mean, I think those are really insightful comments. And I think we are painting broad strokes when we're thinking about this right now. We're looking at the big picture. And I think as we look at the data over time, it's going to reveal a lot more to us. But it is true that I feel like Choma said, there was a lot of work that was produced in the heat of the moment, at this moment of protests and uprising, when people had access to the streets. I mean, remember that people in Minnesota were under stay-at-home orders for a long time. So people were not out in the streets. And suddenly it was possible to go out and really express all of these emotions, all of this anger, all of this loss, all of this hurt, all of that really came out during those moments. And then I think there was a process, like Choma also said, of consensus, where like business owners and community members were all coming together and thinking about how do we craft this message. And I like how Todd framed that as a message that is sometimes about just community, and sometimes it's a vision of what the future can be like and how that can be different. And so that really came out in those works. But a lot of those panels, they're being taken down now as businesses reopen, because there were boards that were protecting the businesses when they were closed, or blocking off windows or something like that. So what will happen when those boards come down? And I think it's possible that some of that justified anger is going to bubble back up. And some things are changing and lots of things are not changing. And there was a sense, to me 5 weeks ago, like, this is it. The world is going to change now. We're done with that past and we're going to move forward a different path. But I mean, I think there's also a sense right now, like, okay, well, what is really happening? It's a slow process. And so I think it's possible that a lot of new voices will also surface again through the form of graffiti and other art as those panels come down. So I'm really, excited, I guess, to see what happens in the future with a lot of these walls around the Twin Cities.
It was interesting driving through town after our initial video interview with a little more open eyes and actually looking at where are the individual pieces of art and what are the calls, so to speak, to action. And it seemed to me that we went from quote unquote crude messaging simply by only having a spray can available to more refined art pieces. Now, whether the narrative under the hood actually truly changed is really difficult for me to say just from an outsider's perspective, but I definitely saw a change in refinement. It became much more artistic, much more expressive through art, as opposed to spraying words on a board. And at the second, on second note, what I've seen is, particularly on the St. Paul side, so Selby Avenue, for instance, a couple of businesses started boarding up and invited artwork onto the boards. So the communal elements became truly transparent and really visible, quite surprisingly so.
Those are such interesting observations, because for me, sometimes the simple words can be super powerful. Like in the very beginning, one of the first things I remember documenting was a simple text that just said mama. And I remember really being struck by the power of just that one word and all that one envisions when you read that piece of text on the wall. That was on the wall near where there was an uprising in St. Paul. And I think right now I'm really struck by this text on a restaurant in Minneapolis that says, don't let them change the narrative. And so much of what we see happening right now is a shifting of the narrative. And sometimes that's helpful and sometimes it actually hinders the cause. So sometimes I think those texts can be really powerful. And sometimes imagery, having looked through, 750 some images right now, sometimes they can be really repetitive and sometimes they lose power through the constant repetition of the same thing. So I think the text and the images sometimes function in different ways and both have their power that they bring to it, but it's just incredibly complex, especially when you see such a huge volume of art being produced around one topic all around the world.
Are the images the street arts, which unfortunately is not as preserved as art that hangs in the gallery because the boards go away, the walls are being painted over. There is, I would say, finite time for street art. So within that time frame provided to the art that's being displayed, does it actually affect the intended change? Does it have the impact that the artists and the community wish to have?
That's a really good question and a difficult question to answer. I'm not sure how we would measure that, right? I'm not sure how we would be able to come to a solid conclusion about that. I do think that we can say, again, maybe, anecdotally is the way to describe the evidence. I do think that, we hear and see people interacting with the art. We hear people talking about the art. I think the art is very much a central element of the movement. And we can see that because of the way that that folks that are involved in the movement are using the art, right? Like they're, it's not just this sort of thing that's apart from what they're doing. I think they see it as very much as central to the work that they're doing. And the fact that artists are some of the most important folks that are at the center of these movements, right? So whether or not we can say that the art is having an impact on, let's say, the everyday person who's just walking down the street, I don't know if we can say that at this point. I mean, that was something that, you know, we were always trying to figure out with our work previous to this in the neighborhood of Midway. You know, how does the normal, regular, everyday person who gets up out of their house and walks down the street to the coffee shop, do they see this mural? Does it matter to them? Do they notice the sidewalk art? Do they notice the tag on the electric box or whatever? And the only way really to figure that out is to ask them that question and see what they say, which is something that we haven't done just yet, but we hope to do. And, you know, my suspicion is that for some people, they won't notice it that much. It won't make that big a difference to them. And for other people, it'll be really profound, that it's a profound alteration of their everyday environment that reminds them that this thing happened. It reminds them of something that they want to fight for. It reminds them of a kind of change and transformation that is important to them. And, you know, when the environment that you exist in is really important to your life, right? I mean, it reflects back on you. And so if you get up every day and you're looking at buildings that are, that look like places you can't go into, like they actually, the architecture or the design of them or the way that they're decorated or anything like that sort of says to you, stay away. That's not necessarily a good way to exist, I guess. But if instead those buildings are covered with art that reflects your own experience, that's a whole sort of different way of being in the world. And I suspect that there are a lot of people that recognize that and feel that.
Let's stay with the idea of experience for a moment. As you look at the images, disassociating yourself from the curation aspect, from the collector's aspect, so to speak, and the categorization, if you will, the cataloging, what is your experience looking at the images as they come in?
You know, I live in Midway, and so I see a lot of this stuff every day, driving, riding my bike, walking around, walking my dog, that sort of thing. And, you know, one of the things about this whole thing that for me personally is this has been this amazing sort of upswell of political, you know, feeling of action. And I haven't really been involved with it that much. Like I haven't been going to marches and things like that because of COVID. You know, I didn't on those days early in the uprising because of COVID. I was afraid. We'd been under lockdown. I wasn't really sure, like, how are people going to be wearing masks? You know, like that part, you know, sort of kept me distanced from the uprising itself. And yet here was all this art and expression and, you know, even stuff that people didn't consider art. And I'm sort of like Heather in that the stuff that really moves me is powerful for me is the stuff that is just tags, you know, that say things like, you know, disparaging things about the police, you know, but they're just these really intense emotional expressions. And for me, to see that stuff all the time reminds me of what happened, keeps me feeling connected to what's going on now and the movement. I feel surrounded by the movement, even if I'm not in the middle of a march or a protest every minute of every day. I'm surrounded by the art that's inspired by that, and that inspires those protests. So, I mean, for me, that's a big part of it. And one other thing I would say is that it's really easy for us in this world of where there's, you know, so much stimulation, so much media, so much, like there's so many things that we pay attention to from the moment we get up until the moment we go to bed. And it's easy to lose sight of something like this that has happened. I mean, we've done it before. We've forgotten the names of people who were killed by the police, partially because there's so many of them, but partially because, you know, just there's so much stuff going on in the world. There's so much stuff we have to pay attention to. And I think that this art in some way, shape, or form helps to remind us. as long as it's there, as long as we're seeing it, it's going to help to remind us that this happened. And so much of it, you know, as I said in the video, so much of it is George Floyd's face again and again and again on boards, George Floyd's face reminding you of what happened and a person who was killed by an institution that we're all implicated in. And that's really, you can't let that go. I mean, it's painful, it's traumatic, but it's necessary.
Heather, when you see the images coming in, does it emotionally affect you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there are so many really powerful images, like Todd said, and it's hard not to be impacted by that and not to really reflect on the society in which we live and all of our roles in making positive changes in that. I feel like working with the images gives me a sense of purpose every day. I'm glad that I have a job doing this and then I'm able to work with these images and really contextualize them. And I think there's a lot of complexity to them too, because I know, having worked with the COVID-19 street art database as well, whenever I see images come in that look at the complexity of the overlap between these issues, this crisis that's, you know, multi-layered and widespread, I really like to think about those images. Like, there are images that say racism is the virus, or images that show protesters wearing face masks, and think about the decisions that people make going to protest, like Todd said, right? It's risky going to a protest simply because of the public health issue, but racism is also a public health issue. And so I really appreciate art that looks at the complexities of that overlap. I think that's really significant.
It's like on one hand, I'm very proud, but on one hand, I'm like just so like defeated in a way, because like Minnesota is a blue state and everyone's, you know, fairly liberal for the most part. And so, but also I think there's a lot of apathy in Minnesota. And so I was like, oh, people don't, you know, no one's really down for the cause of Minnesota. Like no one's like willing to get this angry here. And so that's why the protest really surprised me, because like, are these like Minnesotans getting angry like this? Like, I've never seen this a day in my life. And so when I see, and then like I said, like the pride is from people who wouldn't necessarily consider themselves artists going out and making art and like it reaching, you know, I have a sister who's a little bit younger than me. And so, and she talks about this art as well. She's never actually seen our database. She's only, you know, seen what's been shared on social media. So the fact that it's, you know, reaching teenagers up in the northern parts of Minnesota has been really great. And I think it makes me a little bit sad, just because when you get all this art on an international scale, it makes you think that, well, because it exists everywhere, there's no escape to it, which is like, can be kind of like frustrating sensation. Like, oh, I love seeing all this art, but it's also everywhere, which means all this racism and, you know, behavior exists everywhere. So there really is no escape in that sense.
What have you seen coming in from Europe?
What have I seen coming in from Europe? The one that comes to mind, mainly because we had in our presentation, was the racism is a virus, and it's a black man. I think the person looks a little bit younger in the photo, and he's wearing a mask, and his eyes just look so sad and like frustrated. And that's I don't know if that's like from London, but I know it is from England, which I was at a few months ago. A lot of it, it's like George Floyd base. I've seen some images from protests. It's like a big banner that says, I'm sorry that these are all from like the UK. These are just the ones that just stand out to me because I was on a study abroad there a few months ago. It's something about like the UK, like not being, like they're not innocent in this, you know, in this action. I wish I would have the exact words, but I do not have the exact words yet. But it's a lot of things calling out, a lot of things I've seen trending are from the Europe are calling out their own governments, as in like, we're not innocent. This is not just a US problem, even though like most times in Europe, like the police officers don't have guns. Just calling out the ways that racism exists in their society without it being cop, black person, guns. It comes about in a bunch of different ways. So I've seen a lot of like them calling out the ways it presents itself in them in their society.
the idea of street art, the cataloging, the speaking, the talking about everything that's wrong can eventually lead to just a fatigue point. And suddenly nothing happens, because that would be human nature. It takes us so long to change. Is it going to be different this time?
I think that there is a sustainable kind of feeling of we've got to change things that I think can continue to go and can continue to fuel the movement. I mean, if anything, I mean, so we're like, what, 7 weeks plus after the murder of George Floyd, and people are still moving. I mean, organizations are still coming together, still forming. You know, we were at 38th in Chicago yesterday. There's still people out there. There's still people sitting, you know, in folding chairs under tents with water, you know, like basically tending that site. People are still creating new art. Everything that I've seen so far indicates to me that this is not going to die out anytime soon. At least the energy is there for elements of the movement to continue. Like, maybe there's not going to be a demonstration every single day, but there are going to be organizations that are working on the issues that came out of this movement and continuing to do that every day. And there are going to be artists that see this as like, this is the way that I can contribute. And I think that there's still going to be art that is produced for the foreseeable future. If I could just say a couple things about the database that Absolutely. I say in every interview, is that we still need help. We're still looking for images. We're still accepting images. If you think, I see this image and somebody else has probably already taken a picture of it and sent it in, doesn't matter. Take a picture and submit it anyway, because we don't care if we get duplicates. That's good for the database as well. But we still need everyone's help. And as we were driving across the city yesterday to go over to the memorial site, we saw lots of images, lots of murals and art that we hadn't seen in the database yet. So there's still stuff out there that needs to be documented, and we can't do it all ourselves. We need the help of the community to help us to do this. And people might have images on their phone right now that they took, you know, weeks and weeks ago, that they don't think are that important. It's important to us, and collectively it's important to the community. So please help us if you can.
Is there a particular preference in which you want to be contacted through?
We actually have a submission portal on the database itself. So you just click on contribute an item, you can upload a photo. The thing that's really important for us is being able to have a sense of the location of the work. And we hope to have street address if possible, but even just city is really helpful for us. And then the date that something was documented is really important for us.
And the web address is georgefloydstreetart.omica.net. And also for reference, of course, this will be in the show notes below. With that, Dr. Heather Sherry, Choma Uwagu, Dr. Todd Lawrence, all three of St. Thomas University in St. Paul, with the George Floyd Anti-Racist Street Art Project. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for listening to another special episode of the Here and There podcast of the Germanic American Institute. Of course, our standing invitation, if you do have any questions or would like to suggest topics for future episodes, please do email us at podcast@gai-mn.org. This is Michael. Thanks again for being here. We'll talk to you again soon.